From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has called the House back into session from their corona break for an emergency vote to halt the efficiency steps being taken by Postmaster General. Democrats warn these reforms could imperil the November election. Talking on the Sunday shows, administration officials are pushing back on that narrative.
The president doesn't have a problem with anybody voting by mail if you would look at it in terms of maybe a no-excuse absentee ballot. What he opposes is universal mail-in ballots, where you send millions of ballots out to registered voters across the country, even those that don't request it.
That was White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows on CNN's State of the Union with Jake Tapper. The issue of the post office and universal vote by mail have merged into one issue. We'll talk more about it with the chairman of the House Freedom Caucus, Arizona Congressman Andy Biggs, in just a moment. Also live, or almost live, from Milwaukee, the Democratic National Committee kicks off their four-day virtual convention tonight. Most speakers will actually not be in Milwaukee, but speak remotely or previously recorded. What will the convention focus on? Will it be a parade of the personalities on the left, or do they dare reveal their policy priorities to the nation? We'll talk about it. And I've touched on the topic of how religious freedom in some parts of the world has fallen victim to the coronavirus. A new report from Open Doors USA says when it comes to global coronavirus aid, Christians and other religious minorities worldwide are being forced to decide between giving up their faith or letting their family starve. Dr. David Curry, president of Open Doors, is here with more. In other international news, late last week, the Trump administration announced a peace accord between the UAE and Israel. The announcement is the first Middle East peace agreement with Israel since Jordan and Israel inked an agreement back in 1994. And while the pursuit of peace is and should be a top priority, some evangelicals are concerned about the price of the quest for peace in the Middle East. Florida Congressman Ted Yoho, a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, joins me. We'll also talk with Chris Mitchell, who's in Jerusalem, the Middle East Bureau Chief for CBN News. All of that and more to come up, coming up on this edition of Washington Watch. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter or Parler, it is at T Perkins. All right, we are only a few months away from one of the most important elections in American history. The next president could nominate one or two Supreme Court justices, and policies on abortion, religious freedom, and so on and so forth rest in the hands of the next administration. So the results of this next election need to be accurate. And there are growing concerns over universal mail-in balloting that many states are moving toward. Join me now to talk about this and Speaker Pelosi's calling Congress back from recess to hold hearings about the U.S. Post Office is Congressman Andy Biggs, who is the chairman of the House Freedom Caucus. He represents the 5th Congressional District of Arizona. Congressman, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks, Tony. Good to be with you.
All right. I want to play another clip of your predecessor, actually former chairman of the House Freedom Caucus, now chief of staff to the president of the United States, Mark Meadows, on CNN this weekend discussing the issue of universal mail-in balloting.
We want to make sure that every vote counts, but that only one vote counts. And so when you look at that, this debate is really over a process. A number of states are now trying to figure out how they're going to go to universal mail-in ballots. That's a disaster where we won't know the election results on November 3rd. And we might not know it for months. And for me, that's problematic because the Constitution says that then a Nancy Pelosi in the House would actually pick the president on January 20th. So we need to make sure that we do it right.
Congressman Andy Biggs, do you share his concerns?
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, Tony, some of the evidence that we've seen is in New York's primary, the Democrat primary, mind you, one of every four mail-in ballots was disqualified as fraudulent. And then you go to Clark County, Nevada, they mailed out 223,000 ballots that were returned as undeliverable. So when you start going in this route, the way that the Democrats are, basically you're doing a couple things. You're sowing fear and panic in the public that we're not going to get a fair election. And the other thing that they're trying to do is they would really like to delay this and run the constitutional clock out. So so that Congress gets to determine who the next president is, not the American people.
Now, let's talk for just a moment. I'm going to come back to the election issues. I have another clip from Mark that I want to play. But I want to focus on this call that Nancy Pelosi has issued for the House to come back into session this week to discuss emergency funding for the United States Post Office. I mean, what we actually have here is a kind of a confluence of two different issues. We have a post office that's been losing money for years. You get a businessman that has come in and is reforming the process to make it efficient and cost effective. And now the Democrats trying to cover for what is going to be a flawed system, because there's no way you can transfer to universal mail-in balloting in 2 months. They're trying to make the point of funding for the post office really the scapegoat. Am I correct?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Tony. Just a couple quick points on that. The last package, just a few weeks ago, gave $10 billion in loan money to the U.S. Postal Service. And they don't need that money right now for operations, but it's available to them if they need it. So this administration has done nothing to curb their funding, even though they lost $2 billion last quarter. But they've done nothing to stop that. Then the second point that's so critical to understand is the post office can handle it. They process hundreds of millions of pieces of mail every day. You know who won't be able to handle it? Is the governments that are supposed to count these and verify those ballots. And that's where the problem's really coming in.
That's extremely important to communicate to the American public, because while the post office, I still don't have full confidence in them, because I've had some experience in elections and how they deal with bulk mail and sure. What may happen with ballots. We've actually had fraud cases. But the point, the focus should be on the states, because you often hear. In fact, let me just play this clip, because I think it's important. This is another short clip of Jake Tapper and Mark Meadows yesterday on CNN.
The problem that we have here is a lot of people are looking at just sending out ballots. California is sending out ballots, and where they just send out ballots, my home state of North
California
Carolina.
California already did that for about 75% of its population.
I agree.
Now it's 100%.
Yeah,
but Utah has done it for years. Oregon has done it for years. Washington has done it for years. A lot of these states have done it for years. Nevada, now there are four states that are adding to the sending out ballots to every registered voter. I understand that that's a concern that you're claiming.
What is not talked about, Andy Biggs, is the fact that those states like Washington and Oregon, it took them a decade to put in place the infrastructure to go to all mail-in balloting.
Yeah, absolutely right. And that's part of the rub here is they want to cram this in just a few weeks, actually. And what's going to happen is there's just some important things about that. So the jurisdictions that Tapper is mentioning, they also have ballot harvesting. They allow ballot harvesting. So what that means is you send out these ballots to everybody whose name's on there, whether they're – and they don't allow – first of all, they don't allow you to actually cull or clean up those voter rolls. So these ballots go in all over the place, and then you allow ballot harvesting. Do you not think that that is a recipe for voter fraud? Well, of course it is. And that's if you're really concerned about whether we're going to have election integrity, then you need to stop ballot harvesting and stop. You have to allow cleaning up the rolls so that your dad uncle doesn't get a ballot. We get one of our adult child's ballots here every time, even though we said she doesn't live here. You know, and everybody knows about the famous cats and dogs that get ballots. You know, Fluffy gets a ballot. That's because they won't clean up the rolls. And so all of those have the recipe for disaster if you make universal mail ballot for when states do not have the apparatus to deal with that.
So, Congressman Andy Biggs, the political theater we're going to see in Washington this week as the House comes back in to address this quote-unquote emergency funding for the post office, I mean, this is really a red herring. This is to distract people from the underlying issues that would create uncertainty in the election results, because the states aren't prepared for this. And as you said, and as former Congressman Mark Meadows, chief of staff to the president, said, this puts it into the hands of Congress to decide who the next president is.
Well, that's right. And you know what, Tony? I'm glad you said political theater, because think about this. Nancy Pelosi is going to try to cram something to the House this Saturday. That's not moving a Senate. So that means that it is absolutely theater. It's being done to drive a narrative. And that's what the Democrats do best. They drive narratives. They don't respond to problems. They just actually, frankly, they're creating a problem here and creating a crisis, creating panic in the public that we can't get votes counted. The reality is that her proposal is not going to pass muster in the Senate. So what does it become? It becomes political theater driven by an agenda that's going to foster panic in order to get power. That's what they do.
And to go back, Congressman, to Mark Meadows' first point, the president is not opposed to early voting or absentee voting. That's not the issue here. The issue here is universal mail-in balloting, meaning that every person on the voter roll is mailed a ballot. And as you've pointed out very clearly, these voter rolls are outdated. This is a recipe for corruption. It is a recipe for uncertainty. And again, not to be redundant, but I think people need to understand the long game here. This puts the decision into the hands of Congress, potentially, as to who will be president.
That's right. I mean, if they are able to jumble up the election results enough so that there's confusion and you can't get it completed in time, then it moves to Congress. And that is, boy, that's a recipe for taking away American people's rights. And that's actually an odd move, since the Democrats want a popular election. So that's really, they're undermining the voters completely on that.
That's what they say. That's what they say.
Yeah,
I'm not sure. I'm not sure that's what they want.
That's a fair comment, Tony, because I think what they want is any way to arrogate power to themselves, bring it to the center, and for the Democrats to take power. There's no doubt about that.
Congressman Andy Biggs, thanks so much for taking time out to join us.
My pleasure. Good luck, Tony. Hang in there.
All right. Congressman Andy Biggs of Arizona, chairman of the House Freedom Caucus. And grateful for them, because they do a tremendous job in keeping laser-like focus on conservative issues. And it's, you know, they have been the Freedom Caucus, which I've told the story before, originated in my conference room a number of years ago because of President Trump and his conservative policies. They've elevated the Freedom Caucus to a real position of driving the agenda in Congress. So we're very, very grateful for them. All right, folks, still more Washington Watch to come. We're going to be focusing on the DNC convention, the virtual convention that begins tonight. 4 days. It's in Milwaukee, although not very many people are going to be there. We're going to talk about who's going to be on the stage, figuratively. What will be their focus? Will it be the personalities of the left, or dare they focus on the policies? Do they want America to really know what they're pushing? We're going to talk about that. We're also going to talk about Christians and other religious minorities that are being denied food and other essentials under the coronavirus aid regimes in some Islamic countries. So don't go away. More Washington Watch to come right after this.
Do Christians have a biblical obligation to participate in government? Do Christians have a duty to vote? And if so, what principles should inform them while casting their ballots? How should pastors think about politics, and how can they shepherd their congregations well during an election season? The gospel of Jesus Christ has implications for all areas of our life, including politics. Christians must be prepared to grapple with the moral issues of our day, the reality of our two-party system, and follow our Christian convictions to their logical end by voting for candidates that support clear biblical values. Family Research Council has partnered with 21 state family policy councils for a new edition of Biblical Principles for Political Engagement. This booklet provides biblical wisdom and clear answers to pivotal questions to help you navigate the political landscape. This publication exists to facilitate careful thinking about issues and encourage God-honoring political engagement that filters all issues and candidates through a biblical worldview. To read the full publication, visit frc.org/engage.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man wherever books are sold.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, Hannah.
What's going on? Why so gloomy?
Well, I'm a little disappointed. I had a lot planned to do during the stay-at-home time, and I just didn't do it.
Oh, yeah? What did you have planned that you didn't get to do?
Well, I was actually hoping I would finally be able to get time to do a regular Bible reading routine, and I started a couple of times. I just didn't stick with it.
Don't be too down on yourself. Starting a new routine can be hard, but one way to help is to join in with others and to have a good game plan. I think I have a good solution for you.
Oh, yeah?
Tony Perkins and FRC are doing a 2-year study in the Word. They have it all mapped out.
When did they start? I would be so far behind.
Oh, that's not a problem. You can literally jump in anytime. There's a daily reading, just a couple of chapters a day, with questions to help you think about what you're reading.
Nice. Where can I find this?
Go to frc.org/Bible, and you can get started.
Where's that again?
frc.org/Bible.
Got it. Checking it out now.
This is Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. All right, the Democratic National Convention gets underway tonight in Milwaukee, kind of. In the age of Corona, the convention will be virtual, with most speakers speaking remotely. But what can we expect? Is this going to be a parade of personalities, or dare they talk about their policies? Joining me now to give us a preview, senior editor at PJ Media, Tyler O'Neill. Tyler, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, Tony, glad to be here.
All right, tonight we're going to be hearing from Bernie Sanders, runner-up in the Democratic contest, and John Kasich, who I think came in third in the Democratic primary, right?
In the Republican primary in 2016.
Oh, that's right. He's a Republican. I forgot.
Yeah. It can be easy to forget sometimes, can't it?
So what can we expect? I mean, is this going to be, you know, a personalities of the left on display, or will they get into any policies?
Yeah, I think this will be a far left fest. So what you had, this is following after a few months of Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden sitting down together in a room, getting all these people together and saying, all right, let's hammer out a quote-unquote middle of the road path, a compromise unity platform between the outright socialism of Bernie Sanders and the, I guess I'm a moderate Joe Biden we saw running a few months ago. Now the Joe Biden of a few months ago no longer exists, and we have essentially a Bernie Sanders who is a little bit older, a little bit feebler, and pretends to be a moderate.
All right, so that's tonight. What and this is going to go through Thursday night. Thursday night, Joe Biden will make his acceptance speech from Delaware. He won't be there in Milwaukee. I don't know if he'll be in his basement or he'll come out to do this. But what else can we expect over the next few days?
Yeah, well, expect to see a lot of far left talking points. I mean, you had Governor Andrew Cuomo and Gretchen Whitmer are speaking tonight. They're probably going to hammer home their coronavirus pushes, and the left has been, you know, uplifting them as examples of how to handle the coronavirus. And yet, you know, no, there's silence from that side of the aisle on what Cuomo and Whitmer and some of these other Democratic governors did, forcing nursing homes to accept coronavirus patients from hospitals. But I think each night you're going to see this far left push come up one way or another. Bernie Sanders tonight, AOC is going tomorrow for, I think she complained she only has 60 seconds. So the DNC is trying to hold her back a little, even while.
But originally, I don't think she was slated to speak at all. So I think this is a concession to put her on the stage, which I think they're trying to appeal to, you know, that Marxist element of the party.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Trying hard. And you see that even with, you know, figures who are normally thought of as more middle of the road, like Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi, who are falling over themselves with this radical rhetoric and radical policies. But yeah, we also have, you know, Pelosi and Clinton, of course, is going to come out. And then you have Warren and Obama all on Wednesday. That's going to be a big night. But you're going to have Mayor Pete on Thursday, coming shortly before Kamala, the Bidens, and of course, Joe Biden himself. And that's the night that you might expect to hear something about the Southern Poverty Law Center and the horrible threat that quote-unquote hate groups like yours pose to America, despite the total, you know, discrediting of the SPLC last year.
Yeah, essentially any Bible-believing organization, which it should be a tremendous warning that goes out across America as to what a Biden-Harris administration would look like. I mean, the Department of Justice would be not unlike what the Obama administration was, but heavily influenced, if not directed, by the Southern Poverty Law Center that is anti-Christian and is rabid in advancing the agenda of the left.
Yeah, really rabid. And we just have to watch out for this, because you see, it's not just Buttigieg and Harris and the Bidens, but Chris Coons is coming right before them. And he's also on this list, along with Cory Booker, who's earlier that night, of these Democrats who have gone right after conservative Christian nominees that Trump has put up to judicial slots and other places in the administration. Who they've consistently gone after the conservative Christians with an SPLC-style angle, attacking, you know, the Knights of Columbus and other groups for standing up for traditional values.
Yeah, good point. I mean, that's who is going to be on the stage, front and center, figuratively, because there won't be many people there in Milwaukee. But that is who they're showcasing, and I think that's important to know, that this is the driving agenda. Now, they're not going to talk, most likely, I think, about the policies, because there's such a clear contrast between the two parties when it comes to the policies, that they're going to use these 4 days to bash Trump, you know, go after his personality, go after his tweets, point to the coronavirus. But as you said, I think they will stop short of pointing to their own failures and the fact that they lead states that have the highest death rates, mortality rates from the coronavirus, because of the policies they put in place.
Yeah. And you probably also won't hear about the rising crime and violence that rioters are posing in many of these liberal cities, most notoriously Portland, Seattle, and Chicago. But you probably will hear a little bit about how horrible it was that Trump sent Jack Booted son to face the peaceful protesters, according to their false narrative.
Yeah, right. Got that. All right, Tyler O'Neill, thanks so much for joining us. We're going to be watching with interest. In fact, we'll be watching so most people don't have to.
Yeah.
All right, good to talk with you. Tyler O'Neill. To find out more, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. And as I said, folks, we'll be tuning in, so you don't have to. We'll be watching it to see what... All right, I'll just stop right there. All right, coming up next, we're going to be talking about how Christians and other religious minorities are being denied essential relief as some radical governments refuse to provide aid in the wake of the coronavirus and economic meltdown. That's next with David Curry. Don't go away.
Oh, man.
What's wrong?
I just missed Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, and our congressman was going to be on the show today.
Oh, that's not a big deal.
What do you mean?
Well, you can always catch the replay of the day's show.
How's that?
With the Stand Firm app.
Yeah?
Yep, you can catch that day's program and so much more. You can contact your elected officials on campaigns and policies that are important to you with the Take Action tab. You can listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins live and play previous episodes while conveniently going about your day. You can access the Washington Update, informative blogs, tweets, and critical campaigns on the main feed, so you can stay up to date on local and national news.
Wow, I definitely use that. How do you find the app?
Just visit frc.org/app and download, or search Stand Firm in the App Store.
Okay, that's Stand Firm.
Yep, Stand Firm.
How do you know all this?
Because I'm a SageCon, but that's another story.
Huh?
Are you looking to grow closer in your relationship with Jesus and in your knowledge of God's Word? Family Research Council has released a new 3-part series titled Three Ways to Read the Bible. In this series, Patrina Mosley, FRC's Director of Life, Culture, and Women's Advocacy, shares helpful ways to be encouraged and directed by God's truth through studying and applying the Bible's text. Now's the time to get to know God through His Word by looking into the Bible and learning what it says about God, humanity, and the power of Scripture. During this season of isolation, devote time to the Lord and seek out His meaning for you. In times of crisis and any time, this blog series is a great primer on opening your eyes and heart to Him through His Word. Check out this helpful resource and learn how to read the Bible with not just your eyes, but your heart. To learn more, visit frcblog.com. That's frcblog.com.
Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. The website is tonyperkins.com. If you're on Twitter or Parler, it's at T Perkins. All right, while the coronavirus has led to loss of life and employment in the United States, Open Doors USA reports that Christians in Bangladesh, India, Ethiopia, Malaysia, Sudan, Vietnam, and elsewhere are excluded from food and medical relief distribution in order to pressure their religious conversion. While some states are discriminating against the local church during the pandemic, we need to be informed and compassionate to our Christian brothers and sisters around the world who literally are being denied essential relief like food because everything's shut down. And our economy, you know, we've talked about this before. Our economy is strong and we've got a strong government that's been able to respond. But in many of these countries, they do not. And so people are literally dying from the side effects of the coronavirus. Joining me now to talk more about this is Dr. David Curry. He is the CEO of Open Doors USA. David, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Tony.
All right. This is actually an issue early on during the pandemic that the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom that I serve on spoke to. But now you have documented evidence that this is happening fairly widespreadly, it's fairly widespread in Islamic in countries that have Islamic governments.
Yeah, the extremism is part of the equation here. It really depends on the region as to whether it's Islamic extremists or Hindu. But let me give you an example. In India, we have Christian villages and Christian individuals who are being kept from relief, government relief, from some of their local governments. So it may be that the central government sends out rice and so forth, and these are people who have been, kicked out of their work, they've lost their jobs, these kinds of things. But when the local government, which it might be Hindu, wants to distribute the food, it's not getting to Christians because they're Christians. They're saying that you're not really Indian unless you're Hindu. Same thing in northern Nigeria, where you have a Sharia law states in the north where they're keeping Christians and Christian villages from relief aid. And that means that they're not getting sanitary items, masks, these kinds of things in addition to food. So it's a very significant issue right now.
I mean, think of Nigeria. It's a country where the population is almost split 50-50 between Christians and Muslims. But it's in the regions where the, as you said, the extremists control the reins of government, that they're using this as leverage, especially as I read from your report, it is focused on those in particular who convert to Christianity. They are the first to be denied this relief. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. I mean, it's shocking to know, but there are many cases where people will say, we'll give you food if you just convert back to Islam. There's a lot of pressure in these Sharia law states to enforce adherence to a radical form of Islam. And so Christians in these regions are under tremendous pressure. They might be hungry. They certainly could be out of work due to the COVID pandemic. And you just have a very toxic mix. We want to draw attention to it because we know that this sort of thing flourishes in the darkness. And if we reveal what's happening, unfortunately not a rare situation, then hopefully we could see some improvement.
Now, U.S. officials, in particular, USAID, which is the kind of the humanitarian arm of the State Department, has addressed this issue. But what can they're aware of the issue, and they're making sure that their relief, the U.S. relief, but this is much bigger than that. What can our listeners do to help our government have more of an influence on this?
Well, I think anything we can do to back up a strong message from our senators or the State Department, I think, is helpful to them. In real terms, what you're talking about are weak central governments like Nigeria, where they're not in control or don't seem to want to step up, maybe in some cases, and enforce a rule of law in the northern regions. That's a larger issue than what's happening through USAID. Same thing in India. Now, India is a case where we have strong relationships with India. I think we need to pressure them, continue to bring up the subject, that if we're going to have a friendly relationship with the government there, we certainly, I think we all want that. But it has to be based on common values, of which one is religious freedom, the ability for people to practice their faith privately and whatever faith that is. In this case, it means, freedom for Christians, people to decide they want to be Christians, to have access to humanitarian aid if they are Christians living in a Hindu, predominantly Hindu village. That seems common sense, but I can tell you right now, we've got, I think, 12,000 to 15,000 families that would get no food at all if it weren't for open doors and Christians around the world stepping up to help them to survive in this COVID experience.
And David, folks can partner with you to get relief into the hands of those families that are being denied relief?
Absolutely. OpenDoorsUSA.org has project details there. Places like Nigeria, we're really focusing right now on Africa because some of the echoes of what has been experienced in other areas is really coming down right now in sub-Saharan Africa. But we're also in India, Bangladesh, some of the places you mentioned.
All right, Dr. Curry, we will encourage our folks to do just that. So thanks so much for joining us. And again, appreciate the great work that you do at Open Doors USA.
Thanks to you and your listeners as well. Appreciate it.
And folks, it is an organization that our family supports because I know the work they do, and it's real, it's valuable. I would encourage you to help them, help the families that are being denied relief because they're Christian. Go to TonyPerkins.com, follow the links over. All right, we continue on the international front after this break, looking at the UAE peace accord with Israel. That's next.
The rapidly changing moral landscape of the 21st century presents a challenge for Christians committed to biblical sexual ethics. An uprising against morality has overturned centuries of norms concerning the family, marriage, and human sexuality. Secular culture is not the only challenger of Christian sexual ethics. Increasingly, theologically liberal churches and denominations are rejecting the church's historic teaching on marriage. As a result, Christians are facing increased pressure to compromise the Bible's teaching on human sexuality.
How should Christians who are committed to God's Word respond to these challenges? What does the Bible teach about sexuality? Family Research Council has a new publication that presents the biblical principles for human sexuality. It lays out a survey of culture, scripture, and church history that will help pastors and all Christians meet modern-day challenges to biblical sexuality with truth and love. To access this publication, visit frc.org/sexuality. Again, that's frc.org/sexuality.
In today's culture, it can be difficult for men to navigate what it means to be a man and to find clear models of masculinity and manhood. There are many competing ideas out there and even confusion around the basic concepts of gender and sex. Where can boys, young men, husbands, and fathers find a model of manhood, leadership, and strength in today's culture of confusion? This is Tony Perkins inviting you to join me at a Stand Courageous Men's Conference led by men who are seasoned, compassionate leaders who understand the issues of the day. These issues will invest in unpacking our role as defenders, providers, instructors, and battle buddies so that men can have generational influence as a chaplain inside and outside the home. Join us at one of our upcoming events in Texas, Louisiana, Florida, or Virginia. Learn more about Stand Courageous and find an event near you at StandCourageous.com. That's StandCourageous.com. StandCourageous.com.
With horrifying acceleration in recent years, verified reports of murders, rapes, mutilations, and kidnapping of Christians in Nigeria have persistently increased. These attacks are frequently accompanied by the torching of homes, churches, villages, and agricultural fields. A July 15, 2020 headline reports that over 1,000 Nigerian Christians were killed in the first 6 months of 2020. This is in addition to 11,000 Christians who have been killed since June 2015. News stories about the assaults in Nigeria are rarely reported in mainstream media outlets. But when they are, they're regularly explained away as effects of climate change, local feuds, or religious wars for which both sides bear equal responsibility. For more information about the persecution of Christians in Nigeria, read FRC's publication, The Crisis of Christian Persecution in Nigeria, at frc.org/Nigeria.
This is Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Glad to have you along. The website, TonyPerkins.com, if you're on Twitter, or Parler, at T. Perkins. All right, late last week, the Trump administration announced a historic peace deal between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. Now, the UAE is the third Arab country to normalize ties with Israel after Jordan and Egypt. The last time this happened was with Jordan in 1994, so this is quite significant. In fact, a year and a half, 2 years ago, I'm not sure, it wasn't that long ago, I was in a meeting in the UAE with the Crown Prince, also met with many of the religious leaders in that country. And, you know, quite frankly, they're very American-friendly, and I think it's a great place to start. They're very receptive to religious freedom issues. In fact, probably more than any other country that has an Islamic government, they are favorable to religious freedom, primarily for those who live in the country, not necessarily the citizens of that country, but the citizens only represent about 8% of the country. So anyway, what does this mean for Israel moving forward? How significant is this for the Middle East? Joining me now to talk about the details is Congressman Ted Yoho. He represents the 3rd Congressional District of Florida, and he serves in the House on the Foreign Affairs Committee. Congressman, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, Tony, it's always great to be on, and I appreciate it.
So this is a significant step. It's been since 1994 that we've seen a peace accord like this between Israel and another Middle Eastern country.
Yeah, it is, and it's huge. And it's, you know, you're seeing incremental steps. And I personally think this is a move in the right direction. You know, we've dealt so long trying to get peace between Israel and Palestine. And the Palestinian Authority, when Abbas, he won't recognize the right of Israel to exist.
Right.
It's hard to move forward with that. So instead of, you know, beating your head against the wall, look outside of that. Look outside of the box. And if they can formalize relationships with the UAE, as you pointed out, they're just a great country. They're focused on economics. And if they can do that, I think you'll see other Arab states do the same, whether it's Oman or Bahrain. And I think you'll see some of these other countries do that. And I think that'll send a strong message to the Palestinian Authority that you need to come up with a different plan, because we're moving, the train is leaving the station, and we'd sure like to have you be part of it.
Yeah, and I can't go on the air into a lot of the details, but when I was there, we visited one of the joint anti-extremist task force centers, where they're actually, they're one of the countries, and there are others, that really want to stop the extremism of those that have hijacked the Islamic religion and are using that to foment hate against Israel and others. So they're actually kind of on the cutting edge of doing that there in the UAE, and makes them a natural ally with Israel when it comes to combating terrorism.
They do. And when you can find common ground on things that bring people together, and anti-terrorism is one. Then you put in the Iranian state, which is the largest state sponsor of terrorism. That is really nobody's friend in that area. It makes a stronger alliance. And you know what, Tony, is the beauty of this is the United States is, yeah, we're negotiating, we're helping, but it's not us so much. It's the UAE and Israel. And so it's not an American presence in there per se, other than, you know, on trade and national security issues. And I think this is a smart move. And hopefully, as we know, as time goes on, new generations come forward, and those will be the future leaders, that they'll look at the historic nature of this, and that they'll, you know, they'll make it better.
Yeah, no question. And I don't have time to go into all the history there of the UAE and why they're so favorable to America and, quite frankly, to religious freedom. But it was medical missionaries that helped save the life of the father of the current crown prince. And so there's an openness there to that. But I want to, Congressman Yoho, I want to ask you a question, because there is some reluctance to this, some pushback, not that anyone's against pursuing peace and the strategic moves here, but we've, under the peace plan that was kind of unveiled just a few months ago in Washington with for Israel, part of the issue, and one that many evangelicals were kind of enthused about, was recognizing the right of Israel to exercise sovereignty over areas in Judea and Samaria. That now, as the kind of the give and take here in this peace accord, is, according to the president, off the table. Is there a reason for concern there?
Well, I think it's, is there concern? Well, I think it's something that needs to be watched closely. If you listen to the UAE side, they say off the table. If you listen to the Israeli side, there's a pause on it. And again, I think this gives room for negotiations. If you have absolute stops in at the beginning of an agreement, you can't move forward.
Right.
But if you put pauses in there and work out some of the more intricate details, those other things, I think, will come along. If you look at our Constitution, they had the exclusion clause. We could not talk about slavery for 20 years, and that was when it got signed in and ratified, 1789. They couldn't bring up the slavery issue for 20 years. Had they fought over the slavery issue, we may not have ever had a Constitution. So I think this gives a pause for people to work out some of the details and then move forward.
Yeah, I just hope it is not that pause button doesn't get frozen in place. As we've the ambassador to Israel from the United States, who is a great guy, Ambassador Friedman, he says we have prioritized peace over the sovereignty movement. It's not off the table. It's just something that has been deferred until we have given peace every single chance. And that's a reasonable statement, but we have to keep in mind that is a volatile region, and you know, absolute peace is not something we're ever going to manage to sustain there or acquire. But managing, you know, a sustainable peace is probably should be our top priority, but not at the at the risk of Israel yielding up any sovereignty of its land.
Again, I agree with that, but you can't reach that point if we don't have a starting point. And I what I foresee in the future is that they'll work out an agreement where Samaria, Judea, all these other areas are going to be shared regions mm-hmm. that mutually respect the religion of another nation, but yet we can come together in the name of peace and, you know, take away from it what benefits your country and your people and your religion. And I think if we honor that, because this is really the bedrock of so many great religions in this area, that I think what you'll see is there'll be a mutual respect. But I know this, we can't move forward if we don't have a starting point. And I think this is a great starting point.
That I agree with. From a standpoint of dealing with reasonable people, I do think the leadership of the UAE, some of the other countries there are more reasonable to deal with than those in the Palestinian Authority. So hopefully this will jumpstart it. I just hope it's not, another 25 years before we see movement again.
You and I both talked about the Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed. When I met with him and his one of his aides, Youssef, I walked away from that meeting after I listened to him. I think we had about an hour, hour and a half with him. I was so impressed with him because that was a man that had wisdom mm-hmm. as he was speaking. You could just tell this guy had so much wisdom the way he looked at things. And I came away really impressed, and I think that'll bode well for this agreement.
Yeah, and the good thing is he's actually a mentor to some of the other Middle Eastern country leaders because he does have that wisdom and he's been around a while. So hopefully this will lead to good things. Again, my concern is I don't want to do anything that would jeopardize Israel's sovereignty in any form or fashion. Congressman, as always, great to have you on the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony. Keep up the good work you guys are doing. Thank you. Bye.
All right. Appreciate it. Well, joining us now from Jerusalem is the CBN News Middle East Bureau Chief, Chris Mitchell. Chris, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, Tony. Great to be with you again.
All right, Chris, we were just talking with Congressman Ted Yoho of Florida, who's a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, about the UAE-Israel peace accord that was announced last week. I wanted to go to you to get the feedback that you're getting from Israel. What are you hearing there on the ground?
Well, on the ground, anecdotally, Tony, people that I've talked to on the ground and other people that have talked to Israelis, neighbors, many Israelis like the deal a lot. They like the idea that they would finally have a peace with their Arab neighbors, that either have not had any normal relations at all or sort of had sort of cold peace between Jordan and Egypt, the two countries that there are some sort of relations with Israel. The polls say almost 80% of Israelis favor the deal. In fact, they compare it to the deal with the possibility of annexation of sovereignty, and they favor that over the, quote, annexation. And as we talk about annexation, I think it's important to point out that it's really not annexing land, grabbing land. It's declaring Israeli sovereignty over, the biblical heartland of Israel, of Judea and Samaria. Now, contrasted to many Israelis is the reaction there in Judea and Samaria. And they are quite upset about what happened because they feel like for many weeks and months that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had been telling them, sovereignty is why you should vote for me. Sovereignty is on the table. In fact, July 1st was supposed to be the date when they would declare sovereignty over 30% of Judea and Samaria. Much of that would be the Jordan Valley and then other selected areas in the biblical heartland. So they're very upset. Some are actually asking for Netanyahu to step down. And they're saying that they actually feel like the chances for a Palestinian state may have increased by this. And they're actually met today, I believe, at the Knesset, some of these leaders in Judea and Samaria at the Knesset to hold a meeting to make sure that there's no withdrawals from the biblical heartland.
Chris Mitchell, put some names to some of these cities that we're talking about in Judea and Samaria. These are lands that have long been associated with the Jewish people. We read about them in our Old Testament scripture. So what are some of these, and New Testament, what are some of these cities?
Well, Ariel is one. It's sort of the capital of Samaria, Beth El. That's where Jacob had his dream. Male Damim is not necessarily in the Bible, but that's just outside of Jerusalem. Shiloh, which is where the tabernacle of the Lord was for nearly 400 years. That's where Joshua had the tribes divide up the land of Israel, the promised land. So these are the part of the patriarch's way. This is the land of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so we're going back to the biblical roots of the Jewish people and of Christians. And certainly this is where Jesus talked to the Samaritan woman there in Samaria. So we're talking sites that many people would be familiar with in the Bible.
And Chris Mitchell, they're actually Jewish folks living there. I mean, they're living there. It's not like going in and taking this land. They're already living there.
Oh, yeah, perhaps 300,000, and they had been living there for years, ever since 1967, when during the Six-Day War, Israel reclaimed that land from Jordan, and, you know, that had controlled it from 1948 to 1967. You know, and I think we've talked before, Tony, about what's called the San Remo Resolution. It goes back about 100 years. We're actually, under international law, that land was given as a mandate to the British Empire to establish a Jewish homeland. And so there's not only a biblical, but also historical and international law rights to the land for the Jewish people there.
Now, Chris, there is some discrepancy over how this is being described. The UAE saying annexation sovereignty is off the table. Some in the U.S. and in Israel saying it's only paused. It's just temporary. I mean, that obviously is a very significant factor. But if we're talking about, pursuing peace in exchange for not exercising sovereignty, isn't that kind of the siren call that we've seen in the past for Middle East peace that requires land for peace?
It could be. It could be, Tony. I know if you, right after the announcement, Prime Minister Netanyahu was very clear. He said sovereignty is still on the table. However, if you listen to some of the reports coming out of the UAE, it seems like they're interpreting it as, you know, we have stopped annexation by this peace deal. And apparently Jared Kushner, when he spoke to reporters in just the last day or so, you know, he said that it's off the table for some time. And we don't know what for some time means, but it seems like it's been put back off the table, at least for now. And I know a number of these Jewish leaders in the biblical heartland are wondering if it's going to happen at all.
Mm. Chris Mitchell, thanks so much for staying up late and joining us from Jerusalem.
Great to be with you, Tony.
All right, Chris Mitchell with CBN News. He's the Middle East Bureau Chief. To find out more, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. He has his finger on the pulse of the Middle East. Great source of information for you. All right, folks, out of time. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be tuning in to the DNC convention tonight, so you don't have to, but tune in tomorrow and hear what we got to say. Until then, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, prepared, and taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.